Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the best in late-night radio. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from my little studio beneath the stairs in Old Thornhill, Ontario, just north of Toronto. It's often described as the lost book of the Bible, the Book of Enoch. For hundreds of years, it was accepted by the early church fathers, but then suddenly, it was rejected by the church in AD 364. Today, the uniqueness and mystery of this ancient text have captivated millions. In particular, it is the Book of Enoch's detailed description of the Watchers, or fallen angels, which are only briefly mentioned in Genesis. Enoch also expands upon the Bible's tale of the Nephilim, the human-angel hybrid race of giants. Enoch, and what these giants were, what they looked like, and why God felt they needed to be destroyed. Enoch also reveals which fallen angel specifically is responsible for the Great Flood, and it contains one of the most detailed descriptions of heaven that has currently been discovered. Dr. Michael S. Heiser, author of A Companion to the Book of Enoch, A Reader's Commentary, Volume 1, The Book of Watchers, unpacks this remarkable ancient text, and he'll be here in Hours 1 and 2. Coming up in the second half, what if the United States had gone to war with the Soviet Union? What if they'd fought on land, sea, air, and the astral plane? What if alien technology had fallen into the hands of one of these rival superpowers? What if the Soviets and Americans had struggled for dominion across parallel dimensions? What if they'd summoned demons to gain decisive advantage? What if these two global adversaries could transcend both space and time? How would the world have changed? What wonders could have been unveiled? What terrors could have haunted mankind from those dark and dismal dimensions? A new anthology peers through a glass darkly and discovers the horrifying visions of World War III from some of today's greatest minds in science fiction, fantasy, and horror. The editor, U.S. Army vet and speculative fiction writer Sean Patrick Hazlett, will be here to discuss Weird World War III. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come warm yourself by the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Dr. Michael S. Heiser is a scholar in the fields of biblical studies and the ancient Near East, and he's a scholar in residence at Faith Life that makes the makers of Logos Bible software. Michael has an MA in ancient history from the University of Pennsylvania. He has an MA in Hebrew studies and a PhD in Hebrew Bible and Semitic languages from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Michael can do translation work in roughly a dozen ancient languages, among them Biblical Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, Egyptian, hieroglyphs, and Ugaritic cuneiform. His latest book is A Companion to the Book of Enoch. Michael, welcome back to Coast AM. Good to have you with us. How are you?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
My pleasure. Enoch, he seems like a fairly minor character in the Bible. I think he's just mentioned almost in passing in Genesis. Who was he?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's the biblical figure Enoch, and then there is the Enoch of the Book of Enoch. You know, the Book of Enoch is ostensibly based on that figure, but you know, we should mention there's actually more than one Book of Enoch. That scholars refer to them as first, second, and third Enoch. The one that we think of as the Book of Enoch is First Enoch, and it's the most ancient one. And, you know, that book is essentially built around, or, you know, an expansion of, dramatically, this biblical figure in Genesis 5. But you're right, there's only a couple of verses in Genesis 5 about, you know, this figure we know as Enoch.
And he's mentioned, I think, in a genealogy, which always strikes me as kind of odd. Like, why are we being told this information? You know, why do they go through this whole genealogy? But in the genealogy, Enoch is he the grandfather of Noah?
Well, he's the father of Methuselah, and then of course Methuselah, you know, fathers Lamech, and Lamech fathers Noah. So he's one more degree removed.
Great-great-great-grandfather, right.
Yeah.
Right, and then, of course, we have almost like this spin-off, a book based on this one character. Now, I've read somewhere that he may have been Ethiopian. Is that true?
Well, yeah, he wasn't Ethiopian, but the association is significant. I mean, where you would get this is the notion, you know, that there's a relationship comes from the fact that the Book of Enoch, again, as we know it, is preserved only in the ancient Ethiopic language. It's known as Ge'ez. So, you know, if you're actually looking at, you know, what we have in the Book of Enoch, like how do we even know what this thing was? There are a few fragments of the book in Aramaic that come from the Dead Sea Scrolls, or were found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then from roughly the same period, this is what we call the intertestamental period. The academic term for that is the Second Temple period. It's roughly, you know, 400 BC to 100 AD. But in that same period, you have Greek material of the Book of Enoch that's more than just a few, you know, fragments like the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's substantially more, but it's not the whole book. It's about a third of the book. But and the way you get the rest of it, there's 108 chapters. You know, in the complete Book of Enoch, that only exists in the Ethiopic manuscripts, which are about 14th, 15th century AD. So it's a whole lot later. You know, it's over 1,000 years later than the oldest stuff that we have, the Greek stuff, and then the Aramaic fragments from among the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that's where you get this association of Ethiopia with Enoch.
Ah. Now, in Genesis, it says, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Does that mean that Enoch was raptured?
Yeah, Enoch is one of a couple of biblical characters that never die. I mean, the other one is Elijah. There are other biblical figures, though, that you never find out what happens to them. And so this is Enoch and Elijah, and there are a few others, you know, a few other prophets. If you recall, and your listeners probably recall, there are episodes in the Gospels where Jesus will ask his disciples, hey, you know, who do people think that I am? And they say, well, you know, some think you're Elijah, some think you're some other prophet, you know, like come back, some think you're John the Baptist, you know, come back from the dead. And the reason they thought this is because in Enoch's case, he is taken. So, you know, you use the word rapture. I mean, that's kind of a loaded term, but he is removed, okay? And then we have Elijah, who's removed, but we get the fiery chariot scene. But then we have these other figures that we never find out what happens to them. So there was this whole body of tradition that there were some important figures who, hey, either they didn't die, we know they didn't die, or we don't know what happened to them, and maybe at the end of days, you know, they're going to show up again. So, you know, Enoch is a major figure in that tradition.
And is it believed that Enoch, in fact, is the author of the Book of Enoch, 1, 2, or 3?
Yeah, no, nobody in the academic community believes that, because the oldest manuscript data that we have is about, well, being generous, 300 BC. There's no evidence that Enoch, the biblical figure, wrote what we know as the Book of Enoch. However, there is a very strong tradition that Enoch was a scribe, okay? And part of that is because, you know, you mentioned the genealogies. One of the interesting things about the genealogies, I mean, this is pretty boring material, to be honest with you. You know, so-and-so lived so, you know, so long and fathered XYZ kids, you know.
But yeah, there's a lot of begetting going on.
Yeah, begetting. Is that the genealogy of Genesis 5 has a close relationship to something called the Sumerian King List. And, you know, again, obviously from the title, this is Sumerian material, but The Sumerian king list is a list of kings before the flood. And Genesis 5 is, none of these people are kings. They're never called kings, but you have a, this whole genealogy of people before the flood. And in the two lists, the seventh from the first man, you know, in the biblical language would be the seventh from Adam, is Enoch. And then the seventh from, you know, the first man in the Sumerian list is a figure who is a scribe. Okay, and so there are certain names and things about the people in both lists that, that align, you know, to one degree or another. And so Enoch was considered in great antiquity. Again, this is the biblical version of this Sumerian list. He must have been a scribal figure. And there are other things about him. The scribal tradition before the flood and after the flood is actually really important because in Mesopotamian thought, the way you get the knowledge that created civilization before the flood, which was dispensed by divine beings called the Apkallu. They are the Sumerian Mesopotamian version of the sons of God of Genesis 6, 1 through 4 that cohabit with human women. Okay, their knowledge and their cohabitation is handed down through scribes in Mesopotamian thought. And so, you know, since Enoch was figured, you know, to be a scribal character, he must have something to do with great knowledge. Plus, he's taken to heaven, and he sees things and learns things that nobody else knows. So, it adds to this aura. He's kind of like the Dumbledore of biblical thought. You know, he's this great thinker, this great, you know, genius, this, you know, the scribal art. You know, he's a master of. So he becomes this focus of transmitted knowledge, and so that gets carried out, you know, even beyond the Bible, because like you said, you know, there's only two verses in the actual Bible. But in Jewish literature, you know, extending beyond the Bible, this is a major figure, and the scribal tradition is a big deal. So he's looked at as sort of a fount of esoteric knowledge in antiquity.
So why was the Book of Enoch, why was it not part of the Bible, or why was it removed from the Bible, if that's what happened?
Yeah, it wasn't removed. It was never actually part of any canon list. In other words, the Jewish community never, you know, with one exception, never considered it sacred, inspired canonical literature. And the one exception on the Jewish side were the apparently the people who lived at Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And those people are typically, you know, referred to as the Essenes. And, you know, that's still the best guess, but it's still only a guess as to who they were. But it's the best one. And they quote Enoch the way they quote other books of the Hebrew Bible that they did consider inspired. In other words, they use the same formulaic language, you know, as it is written, you know, but, you know, thus it is written. These same formulaic phrases that they'll use, and then they quote something from Isaiah or Jeremiah. They'll use that language of Enoch. And they also, you know, they wrote commentaries on the books that they considered canonical and inspired. Well, Enoch gets some commentary at Qumran. So there's evidence that at least one sect of ancient Judaism considered this book sacred, but nobody else did. And the reason was, we might hear this and think, well, that's kind of a dumb reason, but it was actually a good reason for them. The reason was that Enoch, again, first Enoch, the Book of Enoch as we know it, there was no evidence that it was written in Hebrew. What we have, the oldest text we have, is in Aramaic, and so their rule of thumb in the Jewish community was, we're not going to consider any book to be inspired, you know, canonical, sacred, unless it was written in Hebrew, because this is the language of the biblical period, you know, the ancient language of our community. So to them, this made a lot of sense. But again, one group made an exception for this book, because it was only in Aramaic, but nobody else did. And because, you know, you have this exception, the book did get a lot of play. A lot of people knew it. New Testament writers knew it. They read it. They quote it once or twice, and they allude to content in it more than that. And because there are certain New Testament writers that had a fondness for the book or found it very useful, that influenced early church figures to think, well, you know, maybe we should loop this one in. And there were, you know, there were a handful, three, four important figures in the early church that thought Enoch should be included, but it was never found in a canon list. You know, the early church actually kept notes on this kind of thing. You know, there were lists of books that should be considered sacred floating around the first couple centuries. Enoch was never on one of them, but it did have its defenders that people said, well, it should be on. Again, three or four people, you know, made that case for it. But again, you know, history looking back on it, they lost that debate. So it was considered important. Some people did think it deserved that status, but no official endorsement of it, in the Christian community anyway, ever happened. And you have one endorsement. The Jewish sect at Qumran thought, yeah, you know, we're going to treat it as such.
And, I mean, I don't need to tell you, people are obsessed with the Book of Enoch. listeners to Coast are absolutely, you know, fascinated by it, and
that
as
is,
we'll discuss
right
about because of the, yeah, because of, you know, the mention of the detailed description of the Watchers and the Nephilim and so forth. But do you think it is, or is there a school of thought that believes it is divinely inspired?
Well, I mean, today you will have people that will talk about it that way. And, you know, to be honest with you, I don't really know why, because there's nothing to hang that hat on. I mean, yes, it did have its defenders. In my commentary, you know, this reader's commentary on the Book of Enoch, which essentially is, it's not a verse-by-verse, line-by-line commentary, but it's kind of like if you had me in the room and you're reading the Book of Enoch and, you know, basically explaining things as you go along here and there. You know, in that book, I have an appendix of the ancient evidence that we have in the early church for who defended this thing. And the two main defenders, Irenaeus and Tertullian, are both going to be dead by the end of the 200s, okay? And so toward the end of their life, I actually have a quote in there that one of them more or less just basically, this is me paraphrasing now, but hey, I've defended this thing, you know, most of my life here, and I really like the Book of Enoch, but apparently, you know, I'm losing the battle. The believing community, you know, just isn't in agreement with me, and so I'm okay with that. I'm going to, you know, give it up. And he did. You know, he deferred to the masses, because what the assumption was that, look, you know, we're all Christians here. We all have the presence of the Holy Spirit in us. And we're going to believe that God, through the Holy Spirit, is going to lead the community to the correct conclusion. And he goes, apparently, I didn't have the correct conclusion, so I'm going to give it up. So people today, I don't know really why they keep hanging on to this, because they don't really have, again, a hat to hang this on. Long before you get to Nicaea, which I think is basically an internet myth that the Council of Nicaea determined what books were in the New Testament. That is simply not the case. But long before you get to Nicaea, Tertullian, Irenaeus, they were dead, and these were the defenders of Enoch. So it sort of peters out, you know, from that point. With one exception, though, the Ethiopian church kept hanging on to it. And again, they're the ones that we have the whole book in their language. So at some point, the ancient material gets lost, but it was put into ancient Ethiopic. And still to this day, they consider the Book of Enoch as sacred. But they're the outlier within the Christian world. But, you know, a lot of people in Protestantism and Evangelicalism, you have a lot of fans, you know, the Book of Enoch. I mean, I know people who love it to that point. They, you know, they want it to be in their New Testament, but again, there's no consensus there, nothing that even approaches that. You have one group that still to this day, you know, is hanging on to it, but they're the only ones, you know, from ancient Africa, the early Western church. Again, they gave up on it after, you know, the 200s AD.
We're heading into a break here. We have a couple minutes, so I just wanted to discuss this aspect of it, and then we'll really unpack it when we come back. And that is, it's known as apocalyptic literature. What do we mean by that?
apocalyptic literature generally is about the end of days, the final judgment, the return of the Messiah, the day of the Lord, you know, when all evil gets judged and the righteous are vindicated, you know, at the end of days. Now, there's more to it than that, literarily speaking. Apocalyptic literature typically has, like, angel characters that interpret visions and, you know, things that the prophet is having about the end of days. So it has a lot of cataclysmic language, you know, the stars falling from heaven and so on and so forth. So there are different features.
Okay.
But generally, it's end of days stuff.
Michael, pardon me the interruption. I've got to take a time out here. Here are the Moody Blues taking us into the break with Ride My Seesaw. More of my conversation with Dr. Michael Heiser on the other side, right here on Coast to Coast AM. NASA is slated to return to the moon in 2024 with its Artemis mission, but it's asking for help from companies to document the trip. The agency sent out a request for partners who would utilize new technologies, including 360-degree field of view camera systems, virtual reality, advanced imagery compression to improve image quality over limited bandwidth, communication links, and more. NASA wants coverage and approaches that will, quote, go beyond our standard coverage on NASA TV, according to Administrator Jim Bridenstine, who said in a statement, we want to capture the awe of Apollo for a new generation, the Artemis generation, just as people were glued to the TV 50 years ago as astronauts took their first steps on the moon. We want to bring people along in this new era of exploration, quote, end quote. And you can read more of this story in the In the News section up at Coast to Coast AM. We'll continue to unpack the Book of Enoch with Dr. Michael Heiser when Coast to Coast AM continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from my little studio beneath the stairs here in Old Thornhill, Ontario. And Dr. Michael S. Heiser is with us. His new one is a companion to the Book of Enoch. Would it be fair to summarize the Book of Enoch as kind of an explanation as to how mankind sort of got in God's bad books?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. You know, it's one thing, just before the break, you know, we said that the Book of Enoch is apocalyptic. Okay, so it's about the end of the world. Well, that begs the question, you know, why are we going to have this cataclysm? Like, what led to that? And that is really largely what the first 36 chapters of the Book of Enoch deals with. You know, the first 36 chapters is what scholars know as the Book of the Watchers. And that, you know, is the question that it tries to answer. So the book opens with, you know, everybody's going to get it. And then it goes into the explanation of why is this happening? And it is traceable to, you know, the Genesis 6, 1 through 4 episode that you read about, you know, in the Bible. So that gets most of the attention. But to be fair, I don't know if that's the right word, but to be fair, the presence of evil on the earth in Enoch is largely attributed to this episode when the sons of God, or as Enoch's favorite term, the Watchers, come down and mingle with human women, and you get the Nephilim and all the chaos that results out of that, and the proliferation of depravity, you know, throughout the whole earth. But there are other hints in Enoch and other Second Temple literature that sound a little bit more like, well, you know, human propensity, you know, to be selfish and to be evil. That has something to do with evil, too. It's not just this sort of angelic source. But in the Book of Enoch, that gets most of the attention. So that is a fair assessment, that Enoch really, you know, lays the blame for the chaos of the world and, you know, God's decision to, you know, terminate evil, terminate wickedness, and save the righteous at the end of days. It's directly linked to this episode. It's a really big deal, you know, in what we call Second Temple Judaism. This is, you know, there are very few things, Richard, that, you know, ancient books, even in one tradition, we'll take ancient Judaism, there are very few subjects that basically all ancient writers are in agreement with. This is actually one of them. Ancient Jewish literature in between the Testaments speaks with one voice on this, that the reason for evil in the world, yes, you know, there's human free will, that plays a part of it, but overwhelmingly they will lay, you know, the tragedy of the human story at the feet of this episode. It's just overwhelming. And, you know, we tend to look at Enoch, and Enoch has lots of fans, and it's always about the Nephilim, always about the freakish, you know, episode here. But the bigger deal are the parts of the Book of Enoch that would say things like, hey, when the Watchers came here, they taught humans certain things. They taught them to basically destroy themselves, weapons of warfare, arts of seduction, astrology, idolatry, all of these things that were self-destructive and destructive to the fabric of human wellness. All of that gets blamed on these guys, on the Watchers. And so that is really, you know, at the core of what the book is about. It's really not, you know, focused on the Nephilim, even though that's part of the story. But the bigger deal is, how in the world did the world get so bad that God has to destroy things, you know, that we have to have an end of days scene? And that's really, again, the answer. It's, you know, what these entities taught humans, basically, so that they would more efficiently destroy themselves and just turn what God wanted in the world into utter chaos. That is the major focus.
What I find interesting, though, is the Book of Enoch, it names names, right? I mean, it actually identifies the fallen angels by name. One in particular that it holds responsible, or Enoch holds responsible, for the Great Flood. Can you tell me about that fallen angel?
Yeah, the one, this really gets us into something interesting, because there's a big academic debate in relation to this, and that is the Book of Enoch consistent, you know, in naming names? Now, for those of you who you know, out there in the audience who have never read it, here's the issue. There is one name, you know, given, you know, right around it. It's First Enoch 16 is when you start getting into the names. And the lead name is Shemichaza, okay, or also known as Semyaz in some manuscripts, or it'll be spelled as S-E-M-J-A-S-E. It has variant spellings. But in certain parts of Enoch, this is the worst of the group, okay, the leader of the bunch. But in other parts of the book, it's an entity known as Asael, A-S-A-E-L, also known as Azazel in different parts of the book. So you have two apparently different characters. Each of the names has a few variant spellings. And so a lot of scholars think that the Book of Enoch, you know, is really a composite of two books, and that somebody tried to put them together and make sense out of this and come up with a narrative, that you've got sort of parts of the book that are contradictory to other parts. You know, I'm not completely convinced of that. You know, there may be a way to sort of align these two, but that's the guy, or those are the guys that you're thinking of, you know, Shemchaza or Azazel, Asael. There's a whole list. There's 20 names. Again, certain texts, you get 19, other ones you get 20. But those are the two names that are the most prominent. And Asael, a.k.a. Azazel, becomes a Satan figure in other Second Temple Jewish material. And so that's where the idea of Satan gets looped into this. Because if you're reading the Bible, you have the serpent of Genesis 3, here the serpent figure who becomes known as Satan eventually. And then you got the Genesis 6 thing. Then you got what happens at Babel. There's a third rebellion. And there's no sense that these three, you know, groups, okay, these three rebellions and those responsible for them, there's no sense in the Old Testament that they're in collusion, that they're working together, that they're part of the same team. But you do get that in between the Testaments, and then, of course, into the New Testament. Then it looks more like a team effort. But in the Old Testament, you have there's this disparate division, or just sort of, they're just there, and there's nothing that links them. But that is not the case, you know, in the Book of Enoch, because you get this Satan figure that develops and has a direct attachment to what happens here.
Does Enoch give us a precise number of how many fallen angels there were?
Well, in First Enoch, you get a list of 20. And these are the 20 that rebelled before the flood. Now, that is not to say that they're the only bad guys that are supernatural in nature. Because, I'll just give you one example. In Enoch, and there are little vestiges of this in the Hebrew Bible in the New Testament, but it's most pronounced in the book of Enoch. Since the spawn of this forbidden union are the Nephilim, when you killed a Nephilim, the Nephilim was like a hybrid, a quasi, you know, divine being, you know, sort of an in-between thing. And so when you killed its body, the disembodied spirit would leave and remain alive. And that, in Second Temple Jewish theology, was where demons came from. So it's like another generation of bad guys. So you have all these, you know, these spirits become demons in addition to the 20 that are listed. So if the 20 get names, you know, demons may or may not get a name in some other, you know, tradition in the Second Temple Jewish, you know, literary output. But so the number is bigger than that. But as far as Enoch goes, it's fairly limited, you know, to this particular group as far as these guys are important enough to give their names.
And does it go into detail as to how they took the daughters of men as their wives? Was it done by force, coercion? Was there some trickery involved? In other words, an exchange, we'll give you technology, you give us your women.
Yeah, see, there's another issue that, again, leads certain scholars, you know, to figure that there's two versions of the book that have been spliced into one, because in certain scenes, you will get this impression that the watchers are seduced, like they can't help themselves. You know, they encounter women and they're just overwhelmed, and they just can't help themselves. And so there's this sort of seduction, and that takes on a sort of voluntary, not a forced, you know, context. In other descriptions of this, you don't have that, and it seems more willful. So because you have the episode described in different ways, again, there's this notion that the book is sort of, you know, spliced together from two versions of this. Again, I think there might be ways, you know, to reconcile those things, but that's kind of an academic discussion that, you know, is probably going to bore the average listener. But, you know, the answer to your question is, yeah, depending on what page you're on, depending on what chapter you're in. It doesn't read as though it was a violent, you know, forcible act for the most part. I mean, you get a little bit of that here and there, but for the most part, it's portrayed as sort of a seduction. Yeah, let's be honest here. I mean, there are a number of scholars who would say that it's portrayed that way to sort of blame women. Okay, you know, there's this streak, you know. In maybe Jewish literature, because, you know, women were of a lower social class, you know, than men, because it was a fairly patriarchal society. Well, that could be, you know, that could be, maybe it's cast that way. But, you know, rather than guessing as to why, it's just a textual question. So this is how it's portrayed, the seduction kind of thing. And I think, you know, I'm more or less content to just leave the text say what it says without guessing as to why it says, you know, that, you know, without getting into sort of social commentary.
And is the first woman who gave birth to a Nephilim, is she identified in Enoch?
Not in Enoch. There, and this isn't the first. There are very few women just generally that are identified, you know, by name, even, you know, in Second Temple Jewish literature. There's, of course, more in the Hebrew Bible. But even Eve, let's just take Eve for an example. You'd think she'd have some prominence. You know, she doesn't factor into the Book of Enoch, at least the first 36 chapters at all. I mean, Adam and Eve get mentioned later. So that isn't unusual. There is another text. It's called the Genesis Apocryphon. This is another text from among the Dead Sea Scrolls that has a scene that relates to this episode, you know, the Watchers and you know, human women. And it's Noah's parents. Okay, so, you know, we have Noah's dad named in the Hebrew Bible, Lamech. Okay, so he's the dad in the Genesis Apocrypha, but now his mom is in the story, and her name is Bitanosh. Okay, so they have an argument in the story where Noah's dad suspects that she's pregnant, but not with his kid. You know, and he asks her, "Is this one of the Watchers' kids?" You know, again, I'm paraphrasing here. And they have an argument. She's like, "No. Don't you remember the other night when we?" And he's like, "Okay." He backs off a little bit. But that's a rare instance when you actually have a woman, you know, mentioned by name that is connected to this episode.
But it's Noah's mother. I mean, what is the implication here that Noah himself was Nephilim?
Well, this that's a good question, because if you ask the average person who really likes Enoch, you know, they're into the Book of Enoch today, they're going to link it to Genesis 6, which is obvious. And there's always this question of, you know, how do we get Nephilim, like, after the flood? Because, you know, we got the Nephilim here in the first few verses of Genesis 6, then we have a flood. And then later on in the Torah, in Numbers chapter 13, verses 32 and 33, the Moses and Joshua and the Israelites after the Exodus, they run into the Anakim, who are very tall. And the verse actually says the Anakim are from the Nephilim, all right? So it creates this whole question, like, how in the world can this be? Because we just had this flood, wasn't everybody killed? And the assumption is that you know, we can't have Noah. I mean, Noah and his family survived the flood. So we can't have this lineage go through Noah, because Genesis 6:9 says that Noah was, you know, upright, you know, pure in his generation. Now, the issue is that isn't convincing to a number of ancient Jewish writers, because the word for generation there in Genesis 6 is not the word for literal, you know, descendants, genealogy. It's the word for generation that we would use something like, you know, hey, I'm from the generation of the 60s. You know, in other words, I'm not related to all the people who lived in the 60s, but I'm from that time period. That's what the actual word is in Genesis 6:9. So there were Jewish writers who looked at that and said, okay, that leaves the door open for Noah or somebody in his family to be sort of a, you know, the blame here, the one through whom the line comes. And some Jewish writers actually thought that it was Noah. They didn't rule him out. There's at least one text that has Noah as a giant. Okay, it's very late. It's a rabbinic text, so it's not as old as the Dead Sea Scroll stuff or the fragments of Enoch. But it shows you that there were ancient Jewish writers that considered this one of the explanations for how we get Nephilim after the flood. But that's unusual. Usually other, you know, writers defaulted to other explanations, you know, for how this would be. But there were some, you know, who thought that. And since you have this episode in this text, the Genesis Apocryphon, where the writer has Noah's parents arguing about this, again, that shows you that writer at least entertained the idea, even though he has Noah's mom denying this. There are other books that have Noah as an unusual child, to put it mildly. Not tall or anything like that, but, you know, sort of glowing skin and, you know, fiery eyes and, you know, crazy hair. And, you know, just stuff that's unusual. And again, what it shows you is that there were people in the Jewish tradition that looked at Noah and did not exempt him from consideration as far as, you know, how we get Nephilim after the flood. They considered him as a candidate. It was just one of several views, but it was a view. You know,
my. Wow, that would change everything. Michael, stay put. We'll take a time out, top of the hour, and we will open the phone lines at the bottom of the next hour. Dr. Michael Heiser, my guest. The book is a companion to the Book of Enoch.